Maybe the Turing people want it kept quiet. Or maybe the AIs have found a way to split parts of themselves off into the Matrix, which would drive the Turings crazy. I knew this Tibetan guy did hardware mod for jockeys. He said they were tulpas. Bobby blinked. A tulpa's a thought form, kind of. Superstition. Really heavy people can split off a kind of ghost made of negative energy. He shrugged. More horseshit. Like Jackie's voodoo guys. Well, it looks to me like Lucas and Beauvoir and the others, they sure as hell play it like it was all real, and not just like it was an act. Jammer nodded. You got it. And they've been doing damn well for themselves by it, too. So there's something there. He shrugged and yawned. I gotta sleep, too. You can do whatever you want as long as you keep your hands off my deck. And don't try to go outside, or 10 kinds of alarms will start screaming. There's juice and cheese and shit in the fridge behind the bar. Bobby decided that the place was still scary, now that he had it to himself, but that it was interesting enough to make the scariness worthwhile. He wandered up and down behind the bar, touching the handles of the beer taps and the chrome drink nozzles. There was a machine that made ice, and another one that dispensed boiling water. He made himself a cup of Japanese instant coffee and sorted through Jammer's file of audio cassettes. He'd never heard of any of the bands or artists. He wondered whether that meant that Jammer, who was old, liked old stuff, or if this was all really new stuff that wouldn't filter out to Barrytown, probably by way of Leon's, for another 2 weeks. He found a gun under the black and silver Universal credit console at the end of the bar. A kind of fat little machine gun with a magazine that stuck straight down out of the handle. It was stuck under the bar with a strip of lime green Velcro, and he didn't think it was a good idea to touch it. After a while, he didn't feel frightened anymore, just kind of bored and edgy. He took his cooling coffee and walked out into the middle of the seating area. He sat at one of the tables and pretended he was Count Zero, top console artist in the sprawl, waiting for some dudes to show and talk about a deal, some run they needed done, and nobody but the Count was even remotely up for it. Sure, he said to the empty nightclub, his eyes hooded. I'll cut it for you, if you got the money. They paled when he named his price. The place was soundproofed. You couldn't hear the bustle of the 14th floor stalls at all. Only the hum of some kind of air conditioner and the occasional gurgles of the hot water machine. Tired of the Count's power plays, Bobby left the coffee cup on the table and crossed to the entranceway, running his hand along an old stuffed velvet rope that was slung between polished brass poles. Careful not to touch the glass doors themselves, he settled himself on a cheap steel stool with a tape-patched leatherette top beside the coat check window. A dim bulb burned in the coat room. You could see a couple of dozen old wooden hangers dangling from steel rods, each one hung with a round yellow hand-numbered tag. He guessed Jammer sat here sometimes to check out the clientele. He didn't really see why anybody who'd been a shit-hot cowboy for 8 years would want to run a nightclub, but maybe it was sort of a hobby. He guessed you can get a lot of girls running a nightclub, but he'd assumed you can get a lot anyway if you were rich. And if Jammer had been a top jock for 8 years, Bobby figured he had to be rich. He thought about the scene in The Matrix, the gray patches and the voices. He shivered. He still didn't see why it meant Lucas was dead. How could Lucas be dead? Then he remembered that his mother was dead. And somehow that didn't seem too real either. Jesus. It all got on his nerves. He wished he were outside, on the other side of the doors, checking out the stalls and the shoppers and the people who worked there. He reached out and drew the velour curtain aside, just wide enough to peer out through the thick old glass, taking in the rainbow jumble of stalls and the characteristic grazing gait of the shoppers. And framed for him, square in the middle of it all, beside a table jammed with surplus analog VOMs, logic probes and power conditioners, was the raceless, bone-heavy face of Leon. And the deep-set, hideous eyes seemed to look into Bobby's with an audible click of recognition. And then Leon did something Bobby couldn't remember ever having seen him do. He smiled. Chapter 23. Closer. The JAL steward offered her a choice of SimStim cassettes. A tour of the Foxton retrospective at the Tate the previous August, a period adventure taped in Ghana, Ashanti, highlights from Bizet's Carmen, as viewed from a private box at the Tokyo Opera, or 30 minutes of Tally Isham's syndicated talk show, Top People.
"Your first shuttle flight, Ms. Ofsky?"
Marley nodded. She'd given Paleologos her mother's maiden name, which had probably been stupid. The steward smiled understandingly.
"A cassette can definitely ease the liftoff. The Carmen's very popular this week. Gorgeous costumes, I understand."
She shook her head in no mood for opera. She loathed Foxton and would have preferred to feel the full force of acceleration rather than live through Ashanti. She took the Isham tape by default, as the least of four evils. The steward checked her seat harness, handed her the cassette and a little throwaway tiara in gray plastic, then moved on. She put the plastic trode set on, jacked it into the seat arm, sighed, and slotted the cassette in the opening beside the jack. The interior of the JAL shuttle vanished in a burst of Aegean blue, and she watched the words Tally Isham's Top People expand across the cloudless sky in elegant sans-serif capitals. Tally Isham had been a constant in the stim industry for as long as Marley remembered, an ageless golden girl who'd come in on the first wave of the new medium. Now Marley found herself locked into Tally's tanned, lithe, tremendously comfortable sensorium. Tally Isham glowed, breathed deeply and easily, her elegant bones riding in the embrace of a musculature that seemed never to have known tension. Accessing her stim recordings was like falling into a bath of perfect health, feeling the spring in the star's high arches and the jut of her breasts against the silky white Egyptian cotton of her simple blouse. She was leaning against a pocked white balustrade above the tiny harbor of a Greek island town, a cascade of flowering trees falling away below her, down a hillside built from whitewashed stone and narrow twisting stairs. A boat sounded in the harbor.
"The tourists are hurrying back to their cruise ship now," Tally said and smiled.
When she smiled, Marley could feel the smoothness of the star's white teeth, taste the freshness of her mouth, and the stone of the balustrade was pleasantly rough against her bare forearms.
"But one visitor to our island will be staying with us this afternoon, someone I've longed to meet, and I'm sure you'll be delighted and surprised, as he's someone who ordinarily shuns major media coverage."
She straightened, turned, and smiled into the tanned, smiling face of Yosef Virek. Marley tore the set from her forehead, and the white plastic of the JAL shuttle seemed to slam into place all around her. Warning signs were blinking on the console overhead, and she could feel a vibration that seemed to gradually rise in pitch.
"Virek?"
She looked at the trode set.
"Well," she said, "I suppose you are a top person." "I beg your pardon."
The Japanese student beside her bobbed in his harness in a strange little approximation of a bow.
You are in some difficulty with your stim?
No, no, she said. Excuse me.
She slid the set on again, and the interior of the shuttle dissolved in a buzz of sensory static. A jarring melange of sensations that abruptly gave way to the calm grace of Tali Isham, who had taken Virik's cool, firm hand and was smiling into his soft blue eyes. Virik smiled back, his teeth very white.
Delighted to be here, Tali, he said,
and Marley let herself sink into the reality of the tape, accepting Tali's recorded sensory input as her own. Stim was a medium she ordinarily avoided, something in her personality conflicting with the required degree of passivity. Virik wore a soft white shirt, cotton duck trousers rolled to just below the knee, and very plain brown leather sandals. His hand still in hers, Tali returned to the balustrade.
I'm sure, she said, that there are many things our audience...
The sea was gone. An irregular plain covered in a green-black growth like lichen spread out to the horizon, broken by the silhouettes of the neo-Gothic spires of Gaudí's Church of the Sagrada Familia. The edge of the world was lost in a low, bright mist, and a sound like drowned bells tolled in across the plain.
You have an audience of one today, Virik said,
and looked at Tali Isham through his round, rimless glasses.
Hello, Marley.
Marley struggled to reach the trodes, but her arms were made of stone. G-force, the shuttle lifting off from its concrete pad. He'd trapped her here.
I understand, said Tali, smiling, leaning back against the balustrade, her elbows on warm, rough stone. What a lovely idea. Your Marley, Herr Virik, must be a lucky girl indeed.
And it came to her, to Marley, that this wasn't SenseNet's Tali Isham, but a part of Virek's construct, a programmed point of view worked up from years of top people, and that now there was no choice, no way out, except to accept it, to listen, to give Virik her attention. The fact of his having caught her here, pinned her here this way, told her that her intuition had been correct. The machine, the structure, was there, was real. Virek's money was a sort of universal solvent, dissolving barriers to his will.
I'm sorry, he said, to learn that you are upset. Paco tells me that you are fleeing from us, but I prefer to see it as the drive of an artist toward her goal. You have sensed, I think, something of the nature of my gestalt, and it has frightened you. As well it should. This cassette was prepared an hour before your shuttle was scheduled to lift off from Orly. We know your destination, of course, but I have no intention of following you. You are doing your job, Marley. I only regret that we were unable to prevent the death of your friend, Alan. But we now know the identity of his killers and their employers.
Tali Isham's eyes were Marley's eyes now, and they were locked with Virik's, a blue energy burning there. Alan was murdered by the hired agents of Mas Biolabs, he continued, and it was Mas who provided him with the coordinates of your current destination. Mas who gave him the hologram you saw. My relationship with Mas Biolabs has been ambivalent, to say the least.
2 years ago, a subsidiary of mine attempted to buy them out. The sum involved would have affected the entire global economy. They refused. Paco has determined that Alan died because they discovered that he was attempting to market the information they had provided, market it to third parties. He frowned. Exceedingly foolish, because he was utterly ignorant of the nature of the product he was offering.
How like Alan, she thought, and felt a wave of pity. Seeing him curled there on the hideous carpet, his spine outlined beneath the green fabric of his jacket.
You should know I think that my search for our boxmaker involves more than art, Marley.
He removed his glasses and polished them in a fold of his white shirt. She found something obscene in the calculated humanity of the gesture.
I have reason to believe that the maker of these artifacts is in some position to offer me freedom, Marley. I am not a well man.
He replaced the glasses, settling the fine gold earpieces carefully.
When I last requested a remote visual of the vat I inhabit in Stockholm, I was shown a thing like three truck trailers lashed in a dripping net of support lines. If I were able to leave that, Marley, or rather to leave the riot of cells it contains, well,
he smiled his famous smile again,
what wouldn't I pay?
And Tally Marley's eyes swung to take in the expanse of dark lichen and the distant towers of the misplaced cathedral.
You lost consciousness,
the steward was saying, his fingers moving across her neck.
It isn't uncommon, and our onboard medical computers tell us you're in excellent health. However, we've applied a derma disc to counteract the adaptation syndrome you might experience prior to docking.
His hand left her neck.
Europe after the rains, she said. Max Ernst. The lichen.
The man stared down at her, his face alert now and expressing professional concern.
Excuse me, could you repeat that? I'm sorry, she said. A dream. Are we there yet at the terminal? Another hour, he said.
Japan Air's orbital terminus was a white toroid, studded with domes and ringed with the dark-rimmed oval openings of docking bays. The terminal above Marley's G-Web, though above had temporarily lost its usual meaning, displayed an exquisitely drafted animation of the torus in rotation, while a series of voices in seven languages announced that the passengers on board JAL's Shuttle 580, Orly Terminus 1, would be taxied to the terminal at the earliest opportunity. JAL offered apologies for the delay, which was due to routine repairs underway in 7 of the 12 bays. Marley cringed in her G-Web, seeing the invisible hand of Virek in everything now.
No, she thought, there must be a way. I want out of it, she told herself. I want a few hours as a free agent, and then I'll be done with him. Goodbye, Herr Virek. I return to the land of the living, as poor Alan never will. Alan who died because I took your job.
She blinked her eyes when the first tear came, then stared wide-eyed as a child at the minute floating spherelet the tear had become.
And Maas, she wondered, who were they?
Vera claimed that they had murdered Alan, that Alan had been working for them. She had vague recollections of stories in the media, something to do with the newest generation of computers,
some ominous-sounding process in which immortal hybrid cancers spewed out tailored molecules that became units of circuitry. She remembered now that Paco had said that the screen of his modular telephone was a Moss product. The interior of the Jal Toroid was so bland, so unremarkable, so utterly like any crowded airport that she felt like laughing. There was the same scent of perfume, human tension, and heavily conditioned air, and the same background hum of conversation. The 0.8 gravity would have made it easier to carry a suitcase, but she only had her black purse. Now she took her tickets from one of its zippered inner pockets and checked the number of her connecting shuttle against the columns of numbers arrayed on the nearest wall screen. 2 hours to departure. Whatever Virik might say, she was sure that his machine was already busy, infiltrating the shuttle's crew or roster of passengers, the substitutions lubricated by a film of money. There would be last-minute illnesses, changes in plans, accidents. Slinging the purse over her shoulder, she marched off across the concave floor of white ceramic as though she actually knew where she was going or had some sort of plan, but knowing with each step she took that she didn't. Those soft blue eyes haunted her. "Damn you," she said. And a jowly Russian businessman in a dark Ginza suit sniffed and raised his newsfax, blocking her out of his world.
"So I told the bitch, see, you gotta get those opto-isolators and the breakout boxes out to Sweet Jane, or I'll glue your ass to the bulkhead with gasket paste."
Raucous female laughter, and Marley glanced up from her sushi tray. The three women sat two empty tables away, their own table thick with beer cans and stacks of styrofoam trays smeared with brown soy sauce. One of them belched loudly and took a long pull at her beer.
"So? How'd she take it, Rez?"
This was somehow the cue for another longer burst of laughter, and the woman who'd first attracted Marley's attention put her head down in her arms and laughed until her shoulders shook. Marley stared dully at the trio, wondering what they were. Now the laughter had subsided, and the first woman sat up, wiping tears from her eyes. They were all quite drunk, Marley decided, young and loud and rough-looking. The first woman was slight and sharp-faced, with wide gray eyes above a thin straight nose. Her hair was some impossible shade of silver, clipped short like a schoolboy's, and she wore an oversized canvas vest or sleeveless jacket, covered entirely in bulging pockets, studs, and rectangular strips of Velcro. The garment hung open, revealing, from Marley's angle, a small round breast sheathed in what seemed to be a bra of fine pink and black mesh. The other two were older and heavier. The muscles of their bare arms defined sharply in the seemingly sourceless light of the terminal cafeteria. The first woman shrugged, her shoulders moving inside the big vest.
"Not that she'll do it," she said.
The second woman laughed again, but not as heartily, and consulted a chronometer riveted on a wide leather wristband.
"Me for off," she said. "Got a Zion run, then 8 pods of algae for the Swedes."
Then shoved her chair back from the table, stood up, and Marley read the embroidered patch centered across the shoulders of her black leather vest. "O'Grady Wajima, the Edith S. Interorbital hauling." Now the woman beside her stood, hitching up the waistband of her baggy jeans.
"Atalyarez, you let that cunt short you on those breakouts? It'll be bad for your name."
"Excuse me," Marley said, fighting the quaver in her voice.
The woman in the black vest turned and stared at her.
"Yeah?"
The woman looked her up and down,
unsmiling.
I saw your vest. The name Edith S., that's a ship, a spaceship.
A spaceship?
The woman beside her raised thick eyebrows.
Oh, yeah, honey. A whole mighty spaceship.
She's a tug,
the woman in the black vest said and turned to go.
I want to hire you, Marley said. Hire me?
Now they were all staring at her, faces blank and unsmiling.
What's that mean?
Marley fumbled deep in the black Brussels purse and came up with the half-sheaf of new yen that Paleologos, the travel agent, had returned after taking his fee.
I'll give you this.
The girl with the short silver hair whistled softly. The women glanced at one another. The one in the black vest shrugged.
Jesus, she said. Where you wanna go? Mars?
Marley dug into her purse again and produced the folded blue paper from a pack of Gauloises. She handed it to the woman in the black vest, who unfolded it and read the orbital coordinates that Alan had written there in green felt pen.
Well, the woman said, it's a quick enough hop for that kind of money. But O'Grady and I, we're doing Zion 2300 GMT contract job. What about you, Rez?
She handed the paper to the seated girl who read it, looked up at Marley and asked,
When? Now, Marley said. Right now.
The girl pushed up from the table, the legs of her chair clattering on the ceramic, her vest swinging open to reveal that what Marley had taken for the net of a pink and black bra was a single tattooed rose that entirely covered her left breast.
You're on, sister. Cash up. Means give her the money now, O'Grady said. I don't want anyone to know where we're going, Marley said.
The three women laughed.
You come to the right gal,
O'Grady said, and Rez grinned. Chapter 24 Run straight down. The rain came on when he turned east again, making for the sprawl's fringe burbs and the blasted belt country of the industrial zones. It came down in a solid wall, blinding him until he found the switch for the wipers. Rudy hadn't kept the blades in shape, so he slowed, the turbine's whine lowering to a roar, and edged over the shoulder, the apron bag nosing past shredded husks of truck tires.
What's wrong?
I can't see. The wiper blades are rotten. He tapped the button for the lights, and four tight beams stabbed out from either side of the hover's wedge of hood and lost themselves in the gray wall of the downpour. He shook his head.
Why don't we stop?
We're too close to the sprawl. They patrol all this. Copters. They scan the ID panel on the roof and see we've got Ohio plates and got a weird chassis configuration. They might want to check us out. We don't want that.
What are you going to do?
Keep to the shoulder until I can turn off, then get us under some cover if I can. He held the hover steady and swung it around in place, the headlights flashing off the day-glow orange diagonals on an upright pole marking a service road. He made for the pole, the bulging lip of the apron bag bobbling over a thick rectangular crash guard of concrete.
This might do it, he said as they slid past the pole.
The service road was barely wide enough for them. Branches and undergrowth scratched against the narrow side windows, scraping along the hover's steel plate flanks.
Lights down there,
Angie said, straining forward in her harness to peer through the rain. Turner made out a watery yellow glow and twin dark uprights.
He laughed. Gas station, he said. Left over from the old system before they put the big road through. Somebody must live there. Too bad we don't run on gasoline. He eased the hover down the gravel slope. As he drew nearer, he saw that the yellow glow came from a pair of rectangular windows. He thought he saw a figure move in one of them. Country, he said. These boys may not be too happy to see us. He reached into the parka and slid the Smith & Wesson from its nylon holster, put it on the seat between his thighs. When they were 5 meters from the rusting gas pumps, he sat the hover down in a broad puddle and killed the turbines. The rain was still pissing down in wind-blown sheets, and he saw a figure in a flapping khaki poncho duck out of the front door of the station. He slid the side window open 10 centimeters and raised his voice above the rain.
Sorry to bother you. We had to get off the road. Our wipers are trashed. Didn't know you were down here.
The man's hands and the glow from the windows were hidden beneath the plastic poncho, but it was obvious that he held something.
Private property,
the man said, his lean face streaked with rain.
Couldn't stay on the road,
Turner called.
Sorry to bother you.
The man opened his mouth, began to gesture with the thing he held beneath the poncho, and his head exploded. It almost seemed to Turner that it happened before the red line of light scythed down and touched him. Pencil-thick beam swinging casually, as though someone were playing with a flashlight. A blossom of red, beaten down by the rain, as the figure went to its knees and tumbled forward. A wire-stocked Savage 410 sliding from beneath the poncho. Turner hadn't been aware of moving, but he found that he'd stoked the turbines, swung the controls over to Angie, and clawed his way out of his harness. I say go, run it through the station. Then he was up, yanking at the lever that opened the roof hatch, the heavy revolver in his hand. The roar of the black Honda reached him as soon as the hatch slid back. A lowering shadow overhead, just visible through the driving rain.
Now!
He pulled the trigger before she could kick them forward, and through the wall of the old station, the recoil jarring his elbow numb against the roof of the hover. The bullet exploded somewhere overhead with a gratifying crack. Angie floored the hover, and they plunged through the wood frame structure, with barely enough time for Turner to get his head and shoulders back down through the hatch. Something in the house exploded, probably a propane canister, and the hover skewed to the left. Angie swung them back around as they crashed out through the far wall.
Where?
She yelled above the turbine. As if in answer, the black Honda came corkscrewing down, 20 meters in front of them, and threw up a silver sheet of rain. Turner grabbed the controls and they slid forward, the hover blasting up 10-meter fantails of groundwater. They took the little combat copter square in its polycarbon canopy, its alloy fuselage crumpling like paper under the impact. Turner backed off and went in again, faster. This time, the broken copter slammed into the trunks of 2 wet gray pines, lay there, like some kind of long-winged fly.
What happened? Angie said, her hands to her face. What happened?
Turner tore registration papers and dusty sunglasses from a compartment in the door beside him, found a flashlight, checked its batteries.
What happened?
Angie said again, like a recording.
What happened?
He scrambled back up through the hatch, the gun in one hand, the light in the other. The rain had slackened. He jumped down onto the hover's hood, and then over the bumpers and into ankle-deep puddles, splashing toward the bent black rotors of the Honda.
there was a reek of escaping jet fuel. The polycarbon canopy had cracked like an egg. He aimed the Smith & Wesson and thumbed the xenon flash twice. Two silent pops of merciless light, showing him blood and twisted limbs through the shattered plastic. He waited, then used the flashlight. Two of them. He came closer, holding the flashlight well away from his body, an old habit. Nothing moved. The smell of escaping fuel grew even stronger. Then he was tugging at the bent hatch. It opened. They both wore image amp goggles. The round, blank eye of the laser stared straight up into the night, and he reached down to touch the matted sheepskin collar of the dead man's bomber jacket. The blood that covered the man's beard looked very dark, almost black in the flashlight's beam. It was Oki. He swung the beam left and saw that the other man, the pilot, was Japanese. He swung the beam back and found a flat black flask beside Oki's foot. He picked it up, stuffed it into one of the parka's pockets, and dashed back to the hover. In spite of the rain, orange flames were starting to lick up through the wreckage of the gas station. He scrambled up the hover's bumper, across the hood, up again, and down through the hatch.
"What happened?"
Angie said, as though he hadn't left.
"What happened?"
He fell into his seat, not bothering with the harness, and revved the turbine. "That's a Hosaka helicopter," he said, swinging them around. "They must have been following us. They had a laser. They waited until we were off the highway. Didn't want to leave us out there for the cops to find. When we pulled in here, they decided to go for us, but they must have figured that the poor fucker was with us. Or maybe they were just taking out a witness."
"His head,"
she said, her voice shaking.
"His head."
"That was the laser," Turner said, steering back up the service road. The rain was thinning, nearly gone. "Steam. The brain vaporizes and the skull blows." Angie doubled over and threw up. Turner steered with one hand, Oki's flask in the other. He pried the snap-fit lid open with his teeth and gulped back a mouthful of Oki's wild turkey. As they reached the shoulder of the highway, the Honda's fuel found the flames of the ruined station, and the twisted fireball showed Turner them all again, the light of the parachute flares. The sky whiting out as the jet streaked for the Sonora border. Angie straightened up, wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, and began to shake. "We've got to get out of here," he said, driving east again. She said nothing, and he glanced sideways to see her rigid and upright in her seat, her eyes showing white in the faint glow of the instruments, her face blank. He'd seen her that way in Rudy's bedroom, when Sally had called them in, and now that same flood of language, a soft, fast rattle of something that might have been patois French. He had no recorder, no time. He had to drive. "Hang on," he said as they accelerated. "You'll be okay." Sure, she couldn't hear him at all. Her teeth were chattering. He could hear it above the turbine. "Stop," he thought. Long enough to get something between her teeth, his wallet or a fold of cloth. Her hands were plucking spastically at the straps of the harness.
"There is a sick child in my house."
The hover nearly left the pavement when he heard the voice come from her mouth, deep and slow and weirdly glutinous.
I hear the dice being tossed for her bloody dress. Many are the hands who dig her grave tonight, and yours as well. Enemies pray for your death, hired man. They pray until they sweat. Their prayers are a river of fever.
And then a sort of croaking that might have been laughter. Turner risked a glance, saw a silver thread of drool descend from her rigid lips. The deep muscles of her face had contorted into a mask he didn't know. Who are you?
I am the Lord of Rhodes.
What do you want?
This child for my horse, that she may move among the towns of men. It is well that you drive east. Carry her to your city. I shall ride her again. And Samedi rides with you, Gunnan. He is the wind you hold in your hands, but he is fickle, the Lord of Graveyards, no matter that you have served him well.
He turned in time to see her slump sideways in the harness, her head lolling, mouth slack.
Chapter 25. Casual Gothic.
This is the Finn's phone program,
said the speaker below the screen.
And the Finn, he's not here. You want to download, you know the access code already. You want to leave a message, leave it already.
Bobby stared at the image on the screen and slowly shook his head. Most phone programs were equipped with cosmetic video sub-programs, written to bring the video image of the owner into greater accordance with the more widespread paradigms of personal beauty, erasing blemishes, and subtly molding facial outlines to meet idealized statistical norms. The effect of a cosmetic program on the Finn's grotesque features was definitely the weirdest thing Bobby had ever seen. As though somebody had gone after the face of a dead gopher with a full range of mortician's crayons and paraffin injections.
That's not natural,
said Jammer, sipping scotch. Bobby nodded.
Finn, Jammer said, is agoraphobic. Gives him the hives to leave that impacted shit pile of a shop. And he's a phone junkie. Can't not answer a call if he's there.
I'm starting to think the bitch is right. Lucas is dead and some heavy shit is going down. The bitch, Jackie said from behind the bar, knows already.
She knows,
Jammer said, putting the plastic glass down and fingering his bolo tie.
She knows. Talked to a hoodoo in the Matrix, so she knows.
Well, Lucas isn't answering, and Beauvoir isn't answering, so maybe she's right.
Bobby reached out and shut off the phone as the record tone began to squeal. Jammer was gotten up in a pleated shirt, white dinner jacket, and black trousers with satin stripes down the leg, and Bobby took this to be his working outfit for the club.
Nobody's here, he said now, looking from Bobby to Jackie.
Where's Bogue and Sharky?
Where's the waitresses?
Who's Bogue and Sharky?
Bobby asked.
The bartenders.
I don't like this. He got up from his chair, walked to the door, and gently edged one of the curtains aside.
What the fuck are those dipshits doing out there?
Hey, Count, this looks like your speed. Get over here. Bobby got up full of misgivings. He hadn't felt like telling Jackie or Jammer about letting Leon see him because he didn't want to look like a Wilson.
and walked over to where the club owner stood.
Go on. Take a peek. Don't let them see you. They're pretending so hard not to watch us, you could almost smell it.
Bobby moved the curtain, careful to keep the crack no more than a centimeter wide, and looked out. The shopping crowd seemed to have been replaced almost entirely by black-crested gothic boys in leather and studs, and, amazingly, by an equal proportion of blonde casuals, the latter decked out in the week's current Shinjuku cottons and gold-buckled white loafers.
I don't know,
Bobby said, looking up at Jammer.
But they shouldn't be together. Casuals and gothics, you know? They're like natural enemies. It's in the DNA or something.
He took another look.
God damn, there's about 100 of them.
Jammer stuck his hands deep in his pleated trousers.
You know any of those guys personally?
Gothics, I know some of them to talk to, except it's hard to tell them apart. Casuals, they'll stomp anything that isn't casual. That's mainly what they're about. But I just been cut up by Lobes anyway, and Lobes are supposed to be under treaty with the Gothics, so who knows?
Jammer sighed.
So I guess you don't feel like strolling out there and asking one what they think they're up to?
No,
Bobby said earnestly. I don't. Jammer looked at Bobby in a calculating way, a way that Bobby definitely didn't like. Something small and hard dropped from the high black ceiling and clicked loudly on one of the round black tables. The thing bounced and hit the carpet, rolling, and landed between the toes of Bobby's new boots. Automatically, he bent and picked it up. An old-fashioned, slot-headed machine screw, its threads brown with rust and its head clotted with dull black latex paint. He looked up as a second one struck the table, and caught a glimpse of an unnervingly agile Jammer vaulting the bar beside the Universal Credit Unit. Jammer vanished. There was a faint ripping sound. Velcro. And Bobby knew that Jammer had the squat little automatic weapon he'd seen there earlier in the day. He looked around, but Jackie was nowhere in sight. A third screw ticked explosively on the formica of the tabletop. Bobby hesitated, confused, but then followed Jackie's example and got out of sight, moving as quietly as he could. He crouched behind one of the club's wooden screens and watched as the fourth screw came down, followed by a slender cascade of fine dark dust. There was a scraping sound, and then a square steel ceiling grate vanished abruptly, withdrawn into some kind of duct. He glanced quickly to the bar, in time to see the fat recoil compensator on the barrel of Jammer's gun as it swung up. A pair of thin brown legs dangled from the opening now, and a gray sharkskin hem smudged with dust.
"Hold it," Bobby said. "It's Beauvoir."
"You bet it's Beauvoir,"
came the voice from above, big and hollow with the echo of the duct.
"Get that damn table out of the way."
Bobby scrambled out from behind the screen and hauled the table and chairs to the side.
"Catch this,"
Beauvoir said, and dangled a bulging olive drab pack from one of its shoulder straps, then let it go. The weight of the thing nearly took Bobby to the floor.
"Now get out of my way."
Beauvoir swung down out of the duct, hung from the opening's edge with both hands, then dropped.
"What happened to the screamer I had up there?"
Jammer asked, standing up behind the bar, the little machine gun in his hands.
"Right here,"
Beauvoir said, tossing a dull gray bar of phenolic resin to the carpet. It was wrapped with a length of fine black wire.
No other way I could get in here without a regular army of shitballs knowing about it as it happens. Somebody has obviously given them the blueprints to the place, but they've missed that one.
How'd you get up to the roof?
Jackie asked, stepping from behind a screen.
I didn't,
Beauvoir said, pushing his big plastic frames back up his nose.
I shot a line of monomol across from the stack next door, then slid over on a ceramic spindle.
His short, nappy hair was full of furnace dust. He looked at her gravely.
You know, he said.
Yes. Legba and Papa Ugu in the Matrix. I jacked with Bobby on Jammer's deck.
They blew Ahmed away on the Jersey freeway. Probably with the same launcher they did Bobby's old lady with.
Who?
Still not sure.
Beauvoir said, kneeling beside the pack and clicking open the quick-release plastic fasteners.
But it's starting to shape up. What I was working on, up until I heard Lucas had been hit, was running down the Loebs who mugged Bobby for his deck. That was probably an accident, just business as usual, but somewhere there's a couple of Loebs with our icebreaker. That had potential for sure, because the Loebs are hot doggers, some of them, and they do a little business with Two-A-Day. So Two-A-Day and I were making the rounds, looking to learn what we could. Which was Dick, as it turned out. Except that while we were with this dust case called Alex, whose second assistant warlord or something, he gets a call from his opposite number, who Two-A-Day pins as a Barrytown Gothic name of Raymond.
He was unloading the pack as he spoke, laying out weapons, tools, ammunition, coils of wire.
Raymond wants to talk real bad, but Alex is too cool to do it in front of us. Sorry, gentlemen, but this is official warlord business, this dumb shit says. So natch, we excuse our humble selves, shuffle and bow and all, and nip around the corner. Use Two-A-Day's modular phone to ring up our cowboys back in the sprawl and put them onto Alex's phone, but fast. Those cowboys went to Alex's conversation with Raymond like a wire into cheese.
He pulled a deformed 12-gauge shotgun, barely longer than his forearm, from the pack, selected a fat drum magazine from the display he'd made on the carpet, and clicked the two together.
You ever see one of these motherfuckers? South African pre-war.
Something in his voice and the set of his jaw made Bobby suddenly aware of his contained fury.
Seems Raymond has been approached by this guy, and this guy has lots of money, and he wants to hire the Gothics outright, the whole apparat, to go into the sprawl and do a number, a real crowd scene. This guy wants it so big, he's gonna hire the casuals too. Well, the shit hit the fan then. Because Alex, he's kind of conservative. Only good casuals a dead one. And then only after X number of hours of torture, etc. Fuck that, Raymond says, ever the diplomat. We're talking big money here. We're talking corporate.
He opened a box of fat red plastic shells and began to load the gun, cranking one after another into the magazine.
Now, I could be way off, but I keep seeing these Moss Biolabs PR types on video lately. Something very weird's happened out on some property of theirs in Arizona. Some people say it was a nuke, some people say it was something else. And now they're claiming their top Biosoft man's dead in what they call an unrelated accident. That's Mitchell, the guy who more or less invented the stuff. So far, nobody else is even pretending to be able to make a biochip. So Lucas and I assumed from the beginning that Moss had made that icebreaker, if it was an icebreaker. But we had no idea who the Finn got it from or where they got it. But if you put all that together, it looks like Moss Biolabs might be out to cook us all. And this is where they plan to do it. Because they got us here but good.
I don't know,
Jammer said.
We got a lot of friends in this building. Had.
Beauvoir put the shotgun down and started loading a Nambu automatic.
Most of the people on this level and the next one down got bought out this afternoon. Cash. Duffels full of it. There's a few holdouts, but not enough.
That doesn't make any sense, Jackie said, taking the glass of scotch from Jammer's hand and drinking it straight off. What do we have that anybody could want that bad?
Hey, Bobby said, don't forget. They probably don't know those lobes ripped me for the icebreaker. Maybe that's all they want.
No, Beauvoir said, snapping the magazine into the Nambu. Because they couldn't have known you hadn't stashed it in your mother's place, right?
But maybe they went there and looked.
So how do they know Lucas wasn't carrying it in Ahmed?
Jammer said, walking back to the bar.
Finn thought someone sent those three ninjas to kill him, too,
Bobby said.
Said they had stuff to make him answer questions first, though.
Moss again,
Beauvoir said.
Whoever, here's the deal with the casuals and gothics. We'd know more. But Alex the Loeb got on his high horse and wouldn't parley with Raymond. No co-employment with the hated casuals. Near as our cowboys could make out, the army's outside to keep you people in. And to keep people like me out. People with guns and stuff.
He handed the loaded Nambu to Jackie.
You know how to use a gun? He asked Bobby.
Sure.
Bobby lied.
No, Jammer said. We got enough trouble without arming him, Jesus Christ.
What all that suggests to me, Beauvoir said, is that we can expect somebody else to come in after us. Somebody a little more professional.
Unless they just blow Hypermart all to shit and gone, Jammer said. And all those zombies with it.
No, Bobby said.
Or else they'd already have done it.
They all stared at him.
Give the boy credit, Jackie said. He's got it right.
30 minutes later, and Jammer was staring glumly at Beauvoir.
I gotta hand it to you. That's the most half-assed plan I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, Beauvoir,
Bobby cut in. Why can't we just crawl back up that vent, sneak across the roof, and get over to the next building? Use the line you came over on.
There's casuals on the roof like flies on shit,
Beauvoir said.
Some of them might even have brain enough to have found the cap I opened to get down here. I left a couple of baby frag mines on my way in.
He grinned mirthlessly.
Aside from that, the building next door is taller. I had to go up on that roof and shoot the monomole down to this one. You can't hand over hand up monomolecular filament. Your fingers fall off.
Then how the hell did you expect to get out?
Bobby said.
Drop it, Bobby. Jackie said quietly. Beauvoir's done what he had to do. Now he's in here with us and we're armed.
Bobby, Beauvoir said, why don't you run the plan back to us? Make sure we understand it.
Bobby had the uncomfortable feeling that Beauvoir wanted to make sure he understood it. But he leaned back against the bar and began.
We get ourselves all armed up and we wait, okay? Jammer and I, we go out with his deck and scout around the Matrix. Maybe we get some idea what's happening.
I think I can handle that by myself, Jammer said.
Shit!
Bobby was off the bar.
Beauvoir said, I want to go, I want to jack. How am I ever supposed to learn anything?
Never mind, Bobby, Jackie said. You go on.
Okay,
Bobby said sulkily. So.